When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
Apple is a really big company. Apple makes a lot of money. Last year, Apple made nearly $100 billion in free cash flow. That's amongst the top earning companies in the world. Apple got this big and makes this much money, not only because they make good products and services, but also because they have constructed an illegal monopoly over the past decade. An ecosystem of products and services that work together and force out competition. A monopoly that serves Apple and Apple's profits, but does not serve competitors or customers. That is the argument that the Department of Justice is making in their new groundbreaking lawsuit against Apple. Apple doesn't agree with the DOJ's characterization of their success. Apple says this lawsuit threatens who we are and the principles that set Apple products apart in fiercely competitive markets. If successful, it would hinder our ability to create the kind of technology people expect to see from Apple, where hardware, software, and services intersect. Apple also believes that the Department of Justice is overstepping their boundaries, not only trying to regulate Apple, but now trying to design consumer products, saying, quote, it would also set dangerous precedent, empowering government to take a heavy hand in designing people's technology. So in this episode, we'll be going over both sides of this case, both the 88-page lawsuit filed by the Department of Justice and Apple's likely rebuttal. I'll be giving you some thoughts on whether or not this is a buying opportunity, a bump in the road for Apple, or whether this presents a long-term risk for the company. So we have a lot to get into this episode. We're going to be breaking down all of that. There's also a couple other things we have to get to in this episode. There's a new company to the stock market. Reddit IPO'd yesterday. It's so new that Qualtrm doesn't even have a logo for it. Regardless, we have some of the early financials of the company. The revenue, the EBITDA, the cash flows, and the shares outstanding. We'll be doing an analysis on the financial situation of Reddit. And we have another upgrade for Google. It is now the best idea for Woodbush, which says that the threat to Google search is overstated. We'll be looking at their arguments of why they have Google as their best idea. Let's first dive into this Apple lawsuit. The first thing I want to mention is that I really like Apple. I like it as both a stock, but also as a company. In fact, I've always liked Apple as a company. I think they make fantastic products. I like just about every single thing Apple makes. I have an iPhone, I have an Apple Watch, I have tablets, I have MacBooks, and I have the Apple TV. My favorite part of Apple products is not just the hardware. I do think the hardware is good. Apple, for example, was one of the first companies to make a laptop that had a really big trackpad, and it worked really well. I remember using PCs before switching to the MacBook, and I just noticed that the trackpad was so much bigger and better. It tracked better. It just worked better all around. I remember the keyboards, the keys on it were just better. The screen had a higher resolution. The speakers were louder and clearer, and the battery life was better. I was impressed that basically every part of the design was superior to the PC that I used to use. After buying a number of Apple devices like this, I became convinced that this company was intensely focused on the quality of products they were designing. They wanted to be differentiated by the quality from the competition. But after using Apple products for a while, I realized that the real value in them is not simply the incredibly good hardware, but it's the seamlessness in which their hardware works together. Every Apple product is like a different form factor of the same overall product, the Apple ecosystem. Every product, whether it's the iPhone, the iPad, the MacBook, the iMac, all of them work seamlessly together. All of your notes sync on the Notes app perfectly. All of your photos sync on the photo apps perfectly. iMessage works perfectly amongst every device. FaceTime works perfectly amongst every device. Every single time, without fail. It's true that Android has syncing capabilities across their devices, but it never seemed to work quite as good. It never seemed to work and function the same way as Apple's. And part of the issue for Android is it's so open, supporting so many devices, so many form factors, that it's difficult to support everything and be seamless and work flawlessly at the same time. The closed ecosystem of Apple is part of the strength that has allowed it to build this seamless experience for its users. A completely open ecosystem that's forced to support anything and everything, thousands upon thousands of different devices, has a much more difficult time building out the same seamless experience that a closed ecosystem does. And Apple has proven that over time. So when I look at Apple as a company and the value proposition it offers to consumers, I see it as twofold. They build incredibly good devices. Just on a one-to-one measurement of the device and the capability, the build and the form factor, I think they build very good devices. The other half of their value proposition to consumers is their incredibly smooth, functional, cohesive, flawless ecosystem, where every device works seamlessly one to another. When you're in the Apple ecosystem, it's as if you bought one big device and every part of it is just a different form factor. These two different value propositions combined, both the high-quality product and the high-quality ecosystem, is an incredible value proposition. And that's why you see so many people choosing Apple and their expensive devices over the cheaper alternatives. Time and time again, people choose Apple routinely over their competitors. So that is how I view Apple. I don't view it as a perfect company. I don't believe that it's without flaw, but I view Apple as an incredibly good company amongst a lot of inferior companies. The way that Apple has executed its plan over time and the value proposition it offers customers, I think is unparalleled. And it must be said that my view on this is not unique. Apple routinely has been rated one of the top most liked companies by customers, typically within the top five. Customers love Apple. Customers love Apple products. They gravitate to this ecosystem because they like the experience. This has been reinforced by study after study after study. But as always, there's two sides to every argument, and the DOJ does not see things this way. They believe that Apple's ecosystem, in particular, has been instrumental in forcing customers to use Apple over competitors and boxing out competition. That is the basis of this lawsuit. This lawsuit is intensely focused on the Apple ecosystem, with the core focuses being the App Store, the Wallet, the Watch, and iMessage. These are different factors of Apple's ecosystem that work better with Apple than they do with other devices. Now, we can go into each of these, but it's important to know that this lawsuit hangs on a lot of statements that I would say are subjective or even false statements. They're based on opinion, and I think the opinion of the DOJ is simply wrong here. For example, on paragraph 10 of the opening introduction, they say that this complaint highlights five examples of Apple using the mechanisms to suppress technologies that would have increased competition among smartphones. Suppressing these technologies does not reflect competition on the merits, rather to protect its smartphone monopoly and the extraordinary profits that monopolies generate. Apple repeatedly chose to make its products worse for consumers to prevent competition from emerging. Apple repeatedly chose to make its products worse for its own customers to prevent competition. That is quite the claim. On the sub-argument here, they mention super apps. Super apps provide a user with a broad range of functionality in a single app. Super apps can improve smartphone competition by providing a consistent user experience that can be ported across devices. Suppressing super apps harms all smartphone users, including Apple users, by denying them access to high-quality experiences, and it harms developers by preventing them from innovating and selling products. This first allegation from the DOJ that Apple denies access to super apps seems like they didn't do their homework or they are grossly misinformed. Apple has no ban on super apps. They support the biggest super app on their phone, which is WeChat in China. In the US, you have Meta, which supports messaging, payment, commerce, all in one app. That is the definition of a super app. So right off the bat, you have claims from the DOJ that are completely unfounded and with no evidence. This is the argument starting off their case against Apple. The next argument the DOJ brings up is cloud streaming. They say cloud streaming game apps could provide users with ways to play computing-intensive games in the cloud. Cloud streaming games and cloud streaming in general can improve smartphone competition by decreasing the importance of expensive hardware to accomplish high compute tasks on a smartphone. Suppressing cloud streaming games harms users by denying them the ability to play high compute games, and it harms developers by preventing them from selling such games to users. Now, they outline that suppressing cloud streaming games is a bad thing, basically alleging that this is what Apple's doing. But the DOJ knows that, again, this is not something that Apple's doing. Apple originally denied cloud streaming games. That was one of the first moves they made, but they quickly reversed it. This was over 2 months ago. Apple is correcting its terrible approval requirements for game streaming apps in iOS 17.4. It's going to be corrected this year. This is already released news. It's established. Apple was already headed this direction before this lawsuit. So the first two complaints they launch are a non-issue. We move on to their next complaint centered around messaging apps. This is where they get into iMessage. Messaging apps are apps that allow users to communicate with friends, family, and other contacts. Messaging apps that work equally well across smartphones can improve competition among smartphones by allowing users to switch phones without changing the way they communicate with friends, family, and others. Apple makes third-party messaging apps on the iPhone worse generally and relative to Apple Messages. Apple's own messaging app, by prohibiting third-party apps from sending or receiving carrier-based messages, by doing so, Apple is knowingly and deliberately degrading quality, privacy, and security for its users who do not have iPhones. Apple also harms developers by artificially constraining the size of their user base. So this third complaint is centered around the blue bubble versus the green bubble. We all know, we've all been there, if you're an Apple user, there's someone in the group conversation that has an Android and they ruin it for everyone. Now everyone has to message the person that has the green bubble and you no longer get those awesome messaging features. And I will say that this does seem like a somewhat valid complaint from the DOJ. They're basically saying that Apple's not playing friendly with other phones and it's kind of degrading the experience for everyone. And I've been there as well. I know someone with the green bubble. And that does create a little bit of awkwardness and a barrier when you're trying to text someone, and it doesn't work quite as well. Unfortunately, for the Department of Justice and their lawsuit that they launched yesterday, months ago, Apple already said that it would support RCS in 2024. They said this November 26th of 2023. So this is something that Apple has released publicly, that they're going to support RCS, which fixes all of the security concerns, all of the messaging problems. Knowing when people are typing, being able to respond with emojis, all those great things are going to be in RCS. If we're keeping track here, this is the third complaint by the DOJ out of the top three, which is a non-issue. Apple has already addressed this and is already moving in this direction. Why is the Department of Justice raising this like it's a grave concern that needs to be fixed when Apple says they're fixing it? They're already moving in this direction. The purpose of lawsuits is to compel companies to move in a certain direction. So why are they suing Apple for something that Apple already said they're doing? This next argument, I believe, is especially misguided by the DOJ. They say that smartwatches are an expensive accessory that typically must be paired to a smartphone. Smartwatches can be paired with different smartphones and allow users to retain their investment in the smartwatch when switching phones, thereby decreasing the literal cost associated with switching from one smartphone to another. By suppressing key functions of third-party smartwatches, including the ability to respond to notifications and messages, and to maintain consistent connection with the iPhone, Apple has denied users access to high-performing smartwatches with preferred styling. Now, again, they're adding in subjective claims here. Apple's denying users their preferred styling because the Department of Justice knows best what your preferred styling is. They also say that they're denying users with better user interfaces and services. That is a wildly obtuse statement for the DOJ to make. They can say definitively what a better user interface and service is. There's better user interfaces and services than the Apple smartwatch. Now, I'm not going to pretend that I know quite as much about user design and consumer preferences as the DOJ does, but I believe the reason that the Apple Watch has dominated every other smartwatch in the category isn't just because of their linkage to the iPhone. It's partly because Apple makes a really, really good watch with a really, really good design, like they do most of their hardware. The Department of Justice is trying to pass through subjective opinions as though it's fact, certified and proven. There's better user interfaces and services out there, but you just don't have access to them because you're stuck with the iPhone. They've also mentioned that it's harmed smartwatch developers by decreasing their ability to innovate and sell products, which of course they have zero evidence for. The reason that I mentioned that this complaint from the Department of Justice is especially egregious is because there's no legal reason that Apple has to open up their accessories for their devices to everyone. This is not a standard that any other company in the world is required to function by. There's no requirement that Sony controllers must be compatible with Xbox, even though they're the largest market share of gaming devices. There's no other reference or standard anywhere throughout business that they can use as a precedent for this claim. This is simply a unique function of them targeting Apple with something they're not targeting any other company with. The argument that every accessory Apple builds should work equally well with competitors is a ridiculous claim. And it's also not a function of how even other phone companies work. Android watches work better with Androids than they do with the iPhone. They do preference their own devices. They work more seamless with it, as they should. Those are the people designing the device. It makes logical sense that the people designing and building and manufacturing the device and the software have it work better with other things they've designed and built. The idea that the DOJ has of taking an accessory device and having it function equally well with other ecosystems that it wasn't built for is absurd. The final complaint the DOJ has is centered around the Apple Wallet. This is the fintech category of Apple. Digital wallets are an increasingly important way that smartphones are used and are a product in which users develop a great deal of comfort and trust as they typically contain users' most sensitive information. Digital wallets that work across smartphone platforms allow users to move from one smartphone brand to another with decreased friction, among other things. Apple has denied users access to digital wallets that would have provided a wide variety of enhanced features and denied digital wallet developers, often banks, the opportunity to provide advanced digital payment services to their own customers. So the complaint is that Apple has one wallet and they keep it all to themselves in a very anti-friendly way. They just hog all the wallet space to themselves, making it difficult for you to transfer to a different phone. This would be a very valid complaint if it was launched over a year ago. From the Apple developer website, Tap to Pay on the iPhone. Payment apps can now accept contactless payment from contactless credit and debit cards, Apple Pay, Apple Watch, and smartphones with other digital wallets, right on the iPhone without any extra terminal or hardware. It seems as though the Department of Justice has been working on this case for like 3 years, and a lot of the complaints they came up with originally have already been solved. Apple may have felt the pressure and already made some changes, and the Department of Justice is like, you know what? We already came up with all of these complaints, even though Apple has solved them. Let's just launch the lawsuit anyways. We don't want to throw away all this effort and time that we put into this lawsuit, so let's just go ahead and sue them anyway. So in this lawsuit, the Department of Justice faces a number of challenges. One of them being the easy Apple defense they can point to and say, look, all of these things that you're complaining about, we're basically doing all of them ahead of time, before this lawsuit was launched. Why are you complaining about things that we're already actively moving to fix? That's one thing they'll be able to point out to the judge. The other challenge for the Department of Justice is proving that they are harming customers, that Apple is actively harming its customer base. It's difficult to prove that for a company that's so chosen so frequently by its customers and receives such positive feedback from customers. Apple have an easy time proving that their customers are extremely happy with their product. The Department of Justice has to create a false narrative. The people only choose Apple because they're locked into the ecosystem. That there's no other preference or reason that Apple is the preferred choice over Android. They'll also have to prove that it's a monopoly, and that users of Apple are simply trapped in and they have no choice in the matter. They can't possibly choose one of the various other cell phones that exist, when there are so many readily available options, and so many ways of transferring over. I think all of that is going to be a big challenge for the Department of Justice. So after looking at the Department of Justice's core arguments, I think the likelihood of them winning this case in a meaningful way is very small. It's very unlikely, in my opinion. I believe the most likely outcome of this is that it is an overhang on Apple stock, that it's something that investors have to concern themselves with in the back of their mind for the next couple of years. And ultimately, I think over the next couple of years, most of these concerns will work their way out. Apple likely won't have to make any meaningful changes. I believe they'll make a few concessions here and there, but ultimately I think it will have minimal impact on the trajectory of Apple and the intrinsic value of the company. It is true that most regulation by the government in an effort to break down big companies typically further solidifies the incumbents. That may not happen here, but that could be the outcome. It's also true that every single time Apple has dipped throughout its entire history because of regulatory concerns has been a buying opportunity. Apple has dipped a little bit this year. It's down 7%. I don't think that's a meaningful dip. The company's still doing incredibly well over the past 5 years. But either way, I see this as unlikely to impact the meaningful long-term trajectory of Apple. It could diminish the moat slightly, but I think that's something that Apple's prepared to deal with. The bigger challenges I believe facing Apple is simply its vast size. The company is already enormous. It already sells 2.2 billion devices that have active users. It already has so many software features it's trying to offer that it's tough for a company of this size to grow in a meaningful way. I think it's going to be a bigger challenge for Apple to find meaningful growth paths than it is to defeat this lawsuit. So as for me, when I look at Apple and this lawsuit, I view it as a slight negative. It could cause potential issues. Right now, it's bringing down sentiment. But overall, I don't think it's the biggest factor we should concern ourselves with Apple. Now, of course, we have to talk about Reddit. This is the new IPO that happened yesterday, a company that was founded in 2005. So it's roughly 18 years old. And we finally get to see the financials of this almost two-decade-old social media company. Now, in Qualtrum, we don't have all the metrics. We'll get them in eventually, especially after the first quarterly report. But we do have some of the financial metrics here. We have the revenue of the company, which is kind of interesting. Reddit actually grew its revenue rapidly from 2020 to 2023. So they're certainly having user growth, engagement growth, and they're adding in a lot more ads. You've noticed that if you've been a Reddit user. In 2020, they did $228 million in revenue. And then the most recent year, 2023, they did $804. So that's very fast revenue growth over a four-year period. I actually like seeing this top line growth for such an old company. But I have a feeling that most of this revenue growth was by shoving in a lot of ads suddenly over the past 4 years. The EBIT of the company has been negative every single year. In 2023, it's slightly less in the red than it was in 2022. So I guess that's a positive movement in the right direction, but they still lost $126 million in EBITDA. Now, of course, we get to the free cash flow, which I believe is the most meaningful metric for profitability, and it also doesn't look great. Reddit has been free cash flow negative since 2020 every single year. 2020 was minus $64 million, 2021 minus $132 million, 2022 minus $100 million, and 2023 minus $84 million. So we have an 18-year-old company that's never generated free cash flow. We also add in stock-based comp. We have to make sure these employees and executives get their payday. While the company is losing cash flow, it is paying its executives and employees handsomely with stock-based compensation. In 2021, we had $149 million. They paid more in stock-based comp than they lost in free cash flow. In 2022, it was $55 million. And then the most recent year, it was $47 million. So they seem to be cutting down on their RSUs, or they've trimmed the amount of employees they have. Either way, their stock-based comp is going down. Now, as you would imagine, a company that's not generating any cash flow, in fact, it's losing money every single year, is also diluting to pay for those developers and executives. They went from 48 million shares outstanding to 59 million over the past 4 years. In the past 1 year, they diluted around 3.3%. When we get to the profitability ratios of the company, this is also where we see a company that you would imagine is immature, a newer one, trying to just get to scale. But we're talking about Reddit here. This is one of the top 10 biggest websites in the world. It's basically the result of every single Google search. This company is at massive scale, and it has been for over a decade. But yet the return on capital employed is negative every single year. The gross margins are very high. Now, the gross margins are high because this company has no real costs of goods. They don't really sell anything that has a physical cost. It's all digital. So they have 86% gross margins. But when we look at their operating margins and we add in those operational costs of paying employees and different operational expenses, the margins go negative, minus 17%. And then the profit margin of the company is minus 11%. I guess it's headed in the right direction. Hopefully they'll have positive profit margins in the future, but right now they have huge operational problems with this company. When we look at the expenses of the company, this is where we see the glaring issues with how they're running their business. In their research and development last year, they spent $438 million on R&D. Their total revenue for the year was $804. So they spent over half of their revenue on R&D. What is a company like Reddit doing spending $400+ million on research and development? That's not counting their sales and marketing. That's not counting their general and administrative. This is just R&D, and they spent almost $500 million for a company like Reddit. They run a website that looks almost no different than it did 10 years ago. I don't like social media companies as investments that much anyway, but I especially don't like Reddit. I think it's right there with other companies like Pinterest and Snapchat, companies that will likely disappoint investors for a long period of time. Now, finally, we have good news for shareholders of Google. It's finally getting upgrades and positive vibes from different analysts, one of them being Wedbush. Google Search faces competitive risks from other generative artificial intelligence players, but one Wedbush analyst says investors' concerns are exaggerated. Scott Devin moved Alphabet to the Wedbush Best Ideas list and increased the stock price target to 175 from 160. They wrote on a note Friday that they believe, quote, the perceived structural risks to Google Search are overstated. Alphabet's competitive advantages are multifaceted. The company has an unmatched breadth of data to develop and train AI models across text, images, and video, a massive user base spanning Google Search, YouTube, Android, and other Google applications, AI-optimized compute infrastructure supported by custom silicon, and access to leading engineering talent, and a proven track record of effective monetization. As evidence of Google's ability to monetize AI and actually make it a good revenue stream, is the talks, the potential deal between Google and Apple to license Gemini as part of Apple devices, to use that AI technology. Apple's a bit behind in AI, so they want to go to a good partner, and they're leaning towards Google. Now, we don't know the specific finances of this potential deal, but it does illustrate that Google does have great potential to monetize their AI. So I agree with the upgrade here. I think Google will be above 175 eventually. Of course, I'm holding the company. I remain bullish on it. That's going to be it for this time. If you want to see more exclusive content, AMAs, lots of different things, you can check out the Patreon. When you join the Patreon, you also get access to Qualtrum.com, which is the analysis website that I built. So try it out for free. There's a link in the pinned comment below. Other than that, I'll see you in the next one.